bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hey.
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Yo.
And the one and only Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
Oh, wait. One of us responded with a sentence. The other two just belted out a syllable. Like
what? Just onomatopoeias.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Efficient, getting right to the point. You know, like, my dad is Scandinavian, and he can either be quite talkative or not talkative at all, right? And if he tells a story, it's great. And he had, you know, Scandinavian relatives were not very talkative. And so I used to kind of think, like, what would a podcast be like with them?
With your dad?
Yeah, I read the book. It was good. Show over.
You know what? That might be kind of fun where it's like every episode, because normally we try to hit a target number of minutes, give or take, on each of our podcasts. What if you totally remove that restriction and each podcast was three questions? And if a podcast deserved to be 5 minutes long, then that's what you got.
And that's what it was.
Just shows up in the feed. It's a 5 minute podcast.
Well, we've talked offline a bit about the idea of super short form, the idea of audio, you know, short form. And now Twitter is launching a thing that's going to be, what was it, like 120 seconds or what was this?
I think it's 120 second native audio, quote unquote, player, but it's really just a video.
It's just
that
a video
they generate like from the audio clip that you upload. So they have invented 120 second videos that are there to play audio.
And I think, piggybacking on how much this is just their video feature, I think they're actually also limited to 2 minutes and 20 seconds because that's how long I've seen audio messages. So which is the recording limit for when you post a video clip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a silly way to do it. I think Twitter could have owned audio clips. I mean, they could have probably owned podcasting on some certain level, like at least a different form of it. But it's Twitter. And I'll tell you what, considering the state of the rest of social media today, I mean, Twitter just being puzzlingly Twitter is probably not the worst thing for them.
Maybe possibly a top move for them to make right now.
Yeah, I don't take such a skeptical approach towards it because I could see a lot of value in, hey, here's my 2 minute review, because I understand it's just an audio and a video, but making it, you know, we could have all, you know, made a lot of stuff before, but once you put it into, you know, who needs Instagram? We got Flickr, you know, and I'm
No. Yeah, sorry. Let me be clear. I don't think that this is a useless feature. I think that it is a good feature. I think this has been a feature that's been there for them for a little while. I was interested to see that when they got into, like, basically, the closest that they got into demonstrating audio was sound cards. So, like, if you put a link in for SoundCloud, it would auto-generate on certain platforms a playable thing that came from that website. I was assuming that if they were going to do their own native audio thing, that it would have looked more like sound cards and less like auto-generating a video. Although that being said, there is a place for auto generating a video. And at that point, what I would hope as they develop it is that they become more either visually exciting or do some of the things that at least selfishly I would love to see, like having auto transcription and stuff like that.
Is it possible to me, the big question is, can you play it with the screen turned off? Like, can you start a feed of Twitter audio and then it just keeps on going and you could just hear the sounds of what the people you like think keep on rolling?
That would be That would be great. We've talked, you know, we've talked a bit offline a lot about like the raw potential of Twitter. And one of the things is they could have owned a large space, yeah, a video 10 years ago too, because there's so much of that shorter form YouTube content stuff. But here I could see a Twitter tab that says, oh yeah, just the audio clips only. And then, yeah, let me just listen to this in the background. Because, man, like I could think of a lot of really cool, like 2 minute content that I would love. And then also the idea is like, if they want to go longer, then it just goes into the next, you can keep going. It'll go into the next 2 minute clip, which is cool. So you could do a 10 minute Twitter cast or whatever you
maybe,
want.
Well, and maybe what you do is just like you have a profile photo. So like, there's a lot of people whose names I follow them and I probably couldn't tell you their name on a dare, but I know their avatar photo, you know? So it's like, I know it's like, oh, it's that guy, whatever. So maybe you just record a 4 second, like, hey guys, it's Brian Brushwood. And then that becomes my avatar. And then that plugs into the feed. And then whatever I have to say from time to time, just, you know, I don't know, plugs into your audio feed.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited, but you know, the going back to the whole, you know, the topic of, you know, just the short audio, whatever. I mean, it's interesting. You know, we saw that, you know, YouTube's announced they're going to be doing 15 second videos, you know, allow the, you know, ability to create that and share that, 'cause they're trying to get into that platform too.
15 seconds. Oof. I mean, what can you get done in that time? You need exactly 1 minute to properly teach a magic trick.
Well, and also Twitter or YouTube has stories. 15 second video doesn't make a lot of sense when you have stories. Just make the stories permanent.
I mean, part of what we're seeing now is that, like, you know, the medium is the message. You're seeing platforms that are developed that find it hard to turn into something else. At a certain point, we understand either inherently the strengths and weaknesses of the platform, and we are less likely to give it a chance, or the platforms themselves find it hard to try and shoehorn in something that obviously consumers want, but they don't have a platform that's built for it. And that's what I think you've seen. I mean, how many different places has YouTube tried to go? They've wanted to be your music. They've wanted to be your cable subscription. They've wanted to be, now they're, I don't know whether or not they went after Vine, but they certainly are going after TikTok now by taking the Vine business model. And live and gaming. They wanted to be Twitch, so they did YouTube gaming. It's interesting. It's interesting to see from these legacy players. Now we think of them as legacy players, which makes us seem really old. But like, there is a worth for a new versus, like, I don't know if TikTok is very successful. I don't know if TikTok could have ever been successful inside YouTube, which is counterintuitive because you would think that it would have a gigantic install base and a head start with, you know, being a part of a larger platform.
Yeah, I think we tend to value things just as much for what they're not as we do for what they are. And I can't think of a better example than texts. Text messaging, for example. What was the name of the movie we watched? Big Time Adolescence.
Yeah,
there's Hulu. There's a brief moment in there where a kid is, a 16-year-old is advised when it comes to dating to call the girl. And he says, what, not text her? And like everyone else does. And it's like, no, don't text. You call.
And then he calls.
And it is just as awkward and weird. It's the weirdest, most awkward thing.
At the end of it, she is charmed by it. But
correct.
She's like, everyone else just texts me. Why don't you just text me? What's wrong with you?
And then, you know, the phone call ends with like, we'll just do that. Like texting explodes for a reason, because there are things that are in between, I need your full attention, and a letter, handwritten letter will do, you know. And I think that Twitter and Vine, RIP Vine, and YouTube are all casting about very carefully, trying to figure out like, what is the part of what we're not that has made us a success so far.
And also, it's like sometimes it works. You know, if you look at Instagram, Instagram looked at Snapchat and said, oh, we can evolve that platform. And Instagram stories became massive. You know, I think there are more people that make Instagram stories than create snaps on Snapchat. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But it really has to it has to fit into that exactly shaped hole that the consumer wants.
The biggest thing that surprised me is that YouTube somehow made the transition into being perceived as a legitimate high quality platform. Like somehow they squeezed out Vimeo, because there was a time that Vimeo was where you went to see anything in HD, and YouTube is where you saw abject garbage cell phone videos. And somehow YouTube squeezed out Vimeo, and they seem to have failed at squeezing anyone else out of anything. Can you think of another?
But Vimeo was never Vimeo launched after YouTube, but it's big capital round, not as YouTube, but as this alternative for like professional services, you know?
Right. But when you thought of Vimeo, you always thought HD in a way that when you thought of YouTube, you thought of crappy cell phone.
Yeah, no, I think brand wise, that's probably still where people think about it. Although it's not cell phone video. Now it's more vlogs and like, hey y'all, like smash the like and subscribe button. Like it's more of that element that YouTube is known for. The only thing that I would say there is that YouTube never really had to do anything other than be like, oh, upload HD video here. And then it would not shock me if never in the history of Vimeo, despite exactly what you said, Brian, of people thinking that one is for one thing and one is the other, that YouTube has not served more high definition video than Vimeo the entire time.
100%. 100%.
Of course, I wonder who's more profitable right now.
That's another thing is that Vimeo, because what Vimeo did do is identify a community for which now all of a sudden you're looking at like, all right, well, creative professionals need a place where they want to curate their experience. They want to share these clips with clients. And so
they also
are willing to write off that expense to make sure that they have as much control over exactly what a professional interaction in a way that YouTube, you know, YouTube might just desync the audio or not load the video. And it's like, whoops, it's YouTube.
And I suppose that's the other thing too. If you want to position yourself, whether it's to distribute your stuff or embed a video on your website or whatever, like, I paid the not YouTube tax for over 10 years. Like I will pay money to not have the watermark that says YouTube on this. Like even if it was secretly like YouTube missed out. What they should have done is launched a second service called Vimeo's that is run by and powered by YouTube, but just doesn't have that YouTube watermark.
Is there a service other than Vimeo where charging the creators has caused it to like be a functioning website? Because I think of SoundCloud, right?
Dropbox.
And SoundCloud for a long time has said like, hey, musicians, pay us and you can have unlimited audio, and then people will listen for free, where you know, versus the other way around.
Oh,
and
that's
like,
the other thing.
Well, and SoundCloud is like constantly failing or on the verge of bankruptcy.
I mean, there are a lot of like the higher tier ones that like, you know, do content delivery networks, but you know, as far as professional hosting,
I mean, Dropbox would be the only thing. Is that if you're getting into the world of like just uploading a bunch of stuff and video being an onerous a place to upload and share, that would be the only other thing that I could think of.
Also, no ads. That was the other thing. Like, I paid. The price, the tax man said, maybe we'll run an ad, maybe we won't. And I was like, all right, look, I'm just going to write a check to Vimeo. And I know that embedded on my professional blog, you're going to see exactly the video that I want.
I pay for Vimeo too, because of that. They solved doing your own video that you don't necessarily need to go viral or whatever really well.
Right.
And that's the thing, is realizing that there was a place where like you don't want this to be seen by other people. You want to have a clean, elegant, and smart experience that is privacy protected in some cases. Like, just the use case on it was totally different.
A big babby in the chat says every hosting service ever always charged the producer.
Well, and I am gearing more towards like social media sites, right? Like, yeah, SoundCloud is big on community, Vimeo is on community, YouTube and such.
But keep in mind also, there was a hot minute that Rooster Teeth like almost couldn't happen because they got too popular, and it was back in the days where they had to pay for the bandwidth. And I believe Vimeo is unlimited. Like if something becomes popular, then they don't come knocking on your door with a $10,000 bill or anything.
Yeah. A number of them now will have like the service level agreements. And so basically they go in and out and they're able to like not meter it. And that's how we did our podcast, is we made a deal with one of our podcast hosts and we're like, you know, can we just, you know, we'll mention you and whatever. And they're like, yeah, sure. And unmetered, you know? And so, you know, it's sometimes we can talk about the after thing. Sometimes you'd be amazed what you can get if you just ask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But speaking of asking, we're asking you for your love, support, and
money, Andrew. It makes the world go round. We're looking for green dollar bills, baby, that you digitally slide into your computer at patreon.com/weirdthings each and every Monday, no matter where we are. We're making this happen. We're bringing it to you, friends. Come on over. Patreon.com/weirdthings. Get the After Things podcast earlier than anybody else. I got to say, I don't know what I would do in life if I didn't have my Patreon custom RSS feeds for Weird Things, for everything else. It is just such a luxury to just get it once and then put it into your RSS feed. If you ever need to pause, it just, there's nothing else you need to do. If you upgrade your Patreon, you don't got to do anything else after that. It just automatically upgrades it. The way to go, patreon.com/weirdthings.
I want to talk about another thing being done by social media, which is Facebook is testing a prediction app where they'll let people basically vote on predictions as far as what they think might be happening in the short-term future.
Wait, so would this be sort of a prediction market, but absent real money?
As far as I can tell, yeah, I don't know if there's any, you know, that's a very good point too, because once you remove the cost of making, you know, where you place your bet, well, you know,
if there's points and credit and you could be better than someone else, as long as you care, I think that's the money is probably makes it a little bit more accurate, but playing for points, I think, would still be a brilliant idea.
Some of the example questions that they have here is, will beaches open this summer in Chicago? How will the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony take place? And the options are in person, virtually, or both. There's, it says price history, which seems weird, but you can see kind of over time how the poll has unfolded.
Yeah, so I guess if you're playing for virtual currency, or points, or, you know, like Hollywood Stock Exchange, it was a significant moment in our movie draft game once we all realized what Hollywood Stock Exchange was good at and not good at. And that's not real money. That's all just fake, you know, internet points and credit and stuff. But when you get a lot of people all betting against each other, whether it's for real money or not, you tend to get a lot more accurate.
It's as you said, you know, points or something where your brain that weighs stakes, you just process it differently. And I'm like, this is cool. I want more stuff like this, more from big tech companies. Let's do some more curious kind of like, there's so much information to get out there besides our social media posts and our angst. There's so much more wisdom of the crowd, so much data there to be had that, you know, it'd be very curious to see. How accurate is it?
I mean, honestly, you want to know the social network that's done the most on this is Pornhub. Like, Pornhub has committed to doing Pornhub Insights, where they take their traffic and they analyze it, they synthesize it, and they put it out to people so people have a friendlier idea of the free pornography website that obviously is their own PR thing. But like, I agree with you, Andrew. I think that there's a million things that you could do that don't show off the worst elements of a social media network if just by their raw numbers and interaction.
I'll tell you what, man, the old cliche, you vote with your feet, means something a little bit different on Pornhub.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, of course, here's the cynical part of me is this looks great, But is this really just another way for Facebook to say, like, which underarm deodorant do you like best? Well, have you tried, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, Brian mentioned, you know, YouTube screwed up by not doing a Vimeo clone, because a Vimeo clone would have been very, very easy for them to do. And they probably could have made a portion, if not all, of the money that Vimeo makes by doing it and just advertising it for free on their platform. But they would never do that, because that doesn't do what Google makes money on. And YouTube existed, and then they got bought by Google, and Google bought them because it's advertising. The most real estate you can create, the more they can sell on top of it. And that's the same thing with this for Facebook. You should look at it skeptically, like it's something that is just there to give you, give its advertisers better analytics on what they should and shouldn't advertise and the crowds they should do it to, because that's their business. Everything needs to be rowing in that direction.
I mean, that's the terrifying thing, right? Is their real job is to know, to just know what everybody's thinking, and to, like a good mentalist, delay on revealing that secret. Collect all the information before the show even starts. Charge everyone, all the advertisers, permission to come on stage or to come to the show. And then after you've charged them, reveal the truth of who wants their product. Ta-da! It was in the sealed envelope the whole time.
No. I love seeing things like that. I was just trying to pull up the site here for that, but
I guess that's the thing is what both Justin and I are weighing is our fascination with what genuine good can come of this, because the wisdom of the crowds is so powerful. But then there's the F word. It's Facebook, you know.
I mean, and look, I think that Facebook, maybe even more than Google, has demonstrated an ability to segment and create other products, because they have seen probably more of an ability that, like, okay, they hire some other company, they buy some other company, and they don't immediately look to fold it in, right? They understand the value of something separate. Whereas Google, I don't think that they have much of that in their DNA, nor have they ever. Everything they purchase is just, they kind of look at as parts that they can plug into their machine.
Andrew, would it be fun to, I guess, what's funny is I was about to ask, would it be fun to speculate about what they might use this for? But I realized that pretty much anything I could come up with would almost certainly have an actual prediction market, but
maybe... Let me give you a data point here. Let me just quick data point. They say we'll be approving users in batches starting with members of the health, research, and academic community. So seems sincere.
Yeah, and it gives you a starting point. Do you remember that brief moment that I forget which branch of the government it was, shortly after 9/11, they realized, like, wow, prediction markets are shockingly accurate. Should we start a prediction market to find out where the next terrorist attack is going to be? Because this would be extremely valuable intel. But then once word leaked out of it, it was found so reprehensible by the public that it, the project was immediately killed. Do you think that removing the money part, even though it makes it less accurate, do you think making it for points would make it more palatable to the populace?
One, it was killed as far as we know. You know, let's I did air quotes there, because like many, many funded government projects, you know, if the PR, like particularly stuff intelligence gathering, if the optics are bad, you change the name and you change the way you announce it.
Behind the curtain.
Yeah, I think here, as long as it doesn't look like, I mean, it doesn't launch with like what looks like, you know, a doomsday, you know, thing, because like the problem with surveys is what happens when any of you guys here, you get a survey, hey, you could win a $100 gift certificate if you fill out our survey.
You do it as fast as possible. Click that first one over and over and over and over and over and over. Give me my gift card.
But really.
I don't answer it in real
yeah,
life.
We don't answer it. Yeah, we don't answer it because, you know, were we, you know, 20-year-old college students or whatever, we might be like, oh yeah, sure. And that's sort of the problem is like, if you're working and you're busy, you see that, oh, a chance to win, F you. No, that means a chance that you're going to waste my time for nothing and I'm not going to do it. And that's one of the big problems of surveys. That was like when they did the book, The Millionaire Next Door. And this, the story, which, you know, maybe apocryphal, was, but in order to get people to talk about how they made their money, he had to offer like $100 to interview them. And he offered $100 to, it was like he paid to interview these people. And they're like, oh, sure. Okay. And boom, it was a small, I forgot the amount was, but it was a small, you know, amount. And all of a sudden people were willing to open up and talk about how they accumulated wealth.
Can I admit one time that I've taken a free survey for a chance to win $500?
Yeah, that's fine.
Did you win?
Sure.
I've done.
It was for Taco.
Can I have some?
It was Taco Bell. But, but
if you're doing a fast food survey and you're not getting a free meal out of it for participating, okay, you are playing yourself.
But
yeah,
it was, what's funny is I didn't even do it for the chance because I knew the chance was garbage. It was because you ever get somebody at a fast food joint?
Is he had bad service?
No, who was great and really cared and then just casually like got everything, like, this is the best service I've ever gotten. And then she just carefully, you know, casually said, hey, by the way, there's a chance to win a survey. But I'm like, oh, like, circle this. That's my number. I don't know if you realize it, but it makes a really big difference. And it's like, and I know for a fact that it does make a very big difference in that person's career if they get somebody to report all 5 stars. So I did the Taco Bell. It was for the person, not for the bell.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I did that.
100%.
Yeah, I went to, there was a Taco Bell with regular. I always did the surveys because they were really good, super kind. Always did the surveys, rated them really well. Never, you know, like I never won anything. It wasn't for it. I've done those like Amazon, like, you know, if you're one of the first, you can get $2, you know, get $2 or $3 to review this product, which is obviously a form of, you know, Amazon supported, you know, vote buying because, well, if I'm making $2 and I got like a few minutes there, oh, I like this product, I'll go do it, you know, so. It is, you know, is yeah. what it is. Okay. I have a price. Yeah. It's $2 is what I'm saying. $2. It's $2.
Well, sorry, even Google has like a form of this, right? The opinion rewards, right? Where people take tons of surveys for like 30 cents each or something. And
yeah.
Did you ever hear, I think it's a Radiolab story about a dude who was like a master reviewer on that and just would play little playful things like make sure that his photo of this one local Santa Fe supermarket had a photoshopped UFO in it and then never mention anything about it. And then for one review, he writes it like a film noir scene, like a hard-nosed detective. He's like, I was two punches down and about out when I walked into this place. And then goes on and just writes this three-paragraph thing. And they, maybe it was a Planet Money or The Indicator. I forget which, doggone it. It was so good. They eventually tracked the guy down, and he was an actor back in the 60s who somehow ended up in Santa Fe. And this is just his thing, is his goal is to review every place, everything in Santa Fe, and each one has a totally, it's his complete creative output, and he puts all of his effort into it. It's amazing.
That's so much talent. somewhere there's like James Patterson has a rival, you know, in an alternate universe.
Yeah.
And this guy's donated hundreds of millions of dollars to children's literary programs. It's improved our overall literacy. hey, to each their own. So I want to talk for a little bit here. And I know like in some of the tech podcasts you guys have done, but I wanted to sort of do the weird things take. Last week was the Worldwide Developers Conference, and Apple announced, among several things, one of them was their transition to building their own chips for their laptops and their iMacs and their Macs, because basically, Apple got more into developing their own processors for the iPhone. They'd first gone to Intel, said, do you want to make a mobile processor? Intel's like, no, there's no money in that. You're not going to sell many. Turned out they sold a few. And right. So Apple started developing more and more. And there's a term that you may hear more and more people talk about SoC, and SoC means system on a chip. So if you make a microchip, it used to be you'd make a microchip that one part of the chip, would just be like all the compute, like all the CPU. And then you might have a separate chip that might have some like a memory card or memory functions, GPU, other functions. And then people started saying, particularly for mobile devices, well, let's put them all on that same silicon, on the same die, so you could have different parts of a chip doing different things. And so in your iPhone, that's one of the things that happens. You might have multiple cores, but you might also have, like, they have a thing called the Neural Engine, which is a chip that's kind of like a GPU designed for doing basically like machine learning tasks. And one of the things that helps do image recognition. And so they started doing that with their iPhones. And their, you know, the new iPad is faster than a MacBook. It's crazy fast because Apple's been able to optimize for that. And they've been looking at their desktops going, man, we'd like these to be faster. And we want to do more interesting stuff than using sort of standard chips. So they've made the decision to, you know, license the ARM technology, but this is going to be very much be a, you know, an Apple chip using some components of that, but a lot of their own custom stuff. And it's a very, very interesting shift because it's going to be expensive and it's a big changeover to try to do that because the underlying architectures are very different. But
would I be super far off in thinking about the divide in the 90s, and this is how this, I'm gonna make it so dumb, between like the way Nintendo versus Sony handled selling games, where it's like Sony busted out software into discs and Nintendo continued with the Super Nintendo to do cartridges, where it's just sort of like you have to plug in that hardware. In my mind, I'm imagining a more kind of cartridge, fully integrated, like whether it's in an iPad or a laptop, it's more of a cartridge mentality. Maybe that's too far of a stretch for the metaphor.
I'm lost.
That's fine. Because part of the reason laptops are made the way the laptops are made is so that you can get the CPU from the CPU place, GPU from a GPU place, you can get the memory from the memory place or whatever. Whereas like on a Sony PlayStation 1 back in the 90s, mm-hmm. you would plug in the disc and it would take all the time in the world to load and put in, internalize all of that stuff. Whereas, you know, Super Nintendo was just cartridge goes in, hardware is all there in one place, just runs. What you're describing sounds close to it, but it sounds like also I'm not familiar enough with enough of the details to keep talking.
Well, I mean, the thing to think about, like, they made the shift to when they shifted to Intel. I remember, like, you know, from a lot of Apple fans, it was like the Pope just announced, "Hey, we're Mormon now." No. But Apple's like, Intel's the biggest chip out there. They're making millions of chips a year. They have more money. They're getting faster than PowerPC. PowerPC was really cool 10 years before, but then there were less users of PowerPC, so it was a market decision. It was just the market wasn't driving PowerPC development the way it was Intel. And Apple's like, we need to shift to Intel if we want to keep having faster computers. And a lot of people don't understand that, but it's like, no, it's like every year there's $3 billion going into Intel development. There's $500 million going into PowerPC, which is going to be better. Now, the most popular chip out there, other than probably like the fact, I mean, you look at, you know, Apple shipping hundreds of millions of iPhone chips, you know, the number of chips out there now, the big market driver is them. And Apple's a $1.5 trillion company. And I've had people like, well, maybe they should let Intel do it. Like, Apple's way bigger than Intel. Apple's much bigger than Intel now. You know, Apple can hire more engineers than Intel. Apple can do all of this. And I think Intel's great. I think they make wonderful stuff. But now they're like, well, what's the biggest leading, you know, the most mass-produced, you know, high-end chip out there? Well, it's the iPhone chip. So maybe we should have our Macs run on that. Or version thereof.
I think it's just, it's a natural progression in terms of how much they've wanted to lean into creating their own chipset. So it makes sense. And if anything, it's like the long-standing narrative since the wild explosion of the iPhone was that, well, how much does Apple really want to be in the, you know, desktop game first, but now even the laptop game, like mobile, is so important for them that I'm glad they're here now.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because that the ability to design your own chips at that high end was a lot more exotic, but now there are a number of fabs that do that. Like Tesla has a next generation of chips that they've developed. And again, you license technologies from other people. You might say, we want the instruction sets from these people and this stuff here, but then we want to do our own custom proprietary stuff. And then you get, you know, special things. If Google cared more about Android, I wouldn't be surprised if they were going to make a move there, but you kind of get the feeling that they don't care as much about Android anymore.
That's interesting because I've always assumed that the Android angle was less that they cared, but more that they were committed to, placing their bet on open architecture. If anybody do what you want.
I don't think those are incompatible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's like for Google, I don't know if it's necessarily not caring. It's just not caring past now. They kind of hit the end of the game. They got the kill screen. Yeah. They got to a market share for which, as an advertising company, they are now able to feel good about. It continues to proliferate. They have really set the standard and now have a big enough stick to wield against competitors to make sure that Google stores, appear on anything that it can. And
I mean, basically,
you know, all right. You got up, did a push up, ate an egg on it. What is he going to do about it?
They're like, yeah, man, we're Pepsi. We're cheaper. We're more ubiquitous. If you're going to open a cost-effective shop, you're probably going to go with us. If you want to pay Coca-Cola prices, I guess you can go with those other guys. Otherwise, what else are you going to do? RC?
I think software-wise and stuff like that, I think Google does a lot of really neat stuff, and I don't want to be like, Android. My friends that are into Android, I get it. I hear you. I understand. I have a couple of Android phones too that I play with because there's some neat stuff on there. But I think they might be becoming RC. That's my fear, is that they're not investing the same amount of money.
Who's Pepsi in this scenario? I guess
none. I don't think there is.
Think they're just drifting farther back.
Look at how much slower the biggest flagship phone is now. There used to be. When they first came out, there was a pretty good back and forth between Android and, you know, iOS as far as speed, whatever. They've done some great stuff on Android, the camera stuff. They've done some great stuff, you know, getting, you know, camera technology, whatever. And I think there have been times when the Android camera was probably better than that year's iPhone camera. But outside of that, a lot of the other things, speed-wise, stuff like that, the speed war iPhone is just killing it. Like, you know, last year's iPhone is still...
I think the battles are just being fought elsewhere. For example, there's still no 5G iPhone and doesn't look like there's going to be one in the next 20 minutes.
I think that, I mean, Apple's always slower to, you know, when there's more 5G, they'll go up to it. I agree. But I'm saying, like, as a chipset sure. and the hardware sort of that... They will, you know, Android will go implement whatever, you know, some manufacturers got. We got the newest thing here, but for their own in-house, let's push this development further. They did the model like the, you know, the window. I mean, I, you know, kind of Windows used the commodity sort of stuff there, but then they never sort of put as big of a, you know, they bought Motorola. Remember they did that, but then we never saw them actually then go pour the money into doing more stuff on that end, which I think, I mean, it might be just a place they're happy with, but man, that distance is just growing.
Yeah.
But look, again, great stuff. Again, no angry letters. We don't angry. I just,
actually,
you know, my
just
market is
any letters. Hit us up.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see Google pouring more money to some of the hardware side of that, like the original hardware, like maybe their own, like improving the chipsets and stuff. I think that could be very interesting. That said, they do great stuff with their software, you know, their, you know, on-device translation stuff, live transcribe, the ability to, like, with their transcription that does punctuation, wonderful stuff. So we'll see. But it's a very interesting transition because now Apple is saying, yeah, we're big enough to do all of this. And I pointed out before, like, they spent billions of dollars on their Project Titan, you know, the project to develop their own car. And that thing just... You know, it's not going to work. Pull the plug on that. Billions. Pulled the plug on it. When you're worth $1.5 trillion. Another thing I'll point out, and Bryce, maybe you can find this out. If you look up the Worldwide Developers Conference, they showed some more stuff for the augmented reality, which we know they're planning to make a big thing. We talked before about the augmented reality glasses, but they had a really cool demonstration showing occlusion. And occlusion is the idea that if you're looking at a scene around you, you want the 3D objects to be able to go behind things. And so they had a demo where they showed a tree and, you know, somebody's looking at it using the iPad to look at it and see this bug crawl around the tree and then a bug going up steps and you blow up the bug and all the parts of the bug fall down on the steps. And what they're able to do is they're mapping everything using the LiDAR on the iPad doing this. And years ago, I point out, you know, Google had a project like Jupiter, which was a standalone separate device to do environment mapping. And there's some other companies working on the tool to create 3D maps of this. But the LiDAR sensor they're putting on the iPad makes it a lot easier. And it's kind of cool to see the depth maps that it shows.
So yeah, we'll see if we. I'm so curious. And this is going to come across. I'm apologies in advance if it comes across as poo-pooing, but it's more. I sincerely mean this as I wish I understood, or I wish I saw the vision of where they're going to head with this, because like we had a similar conversation a while ago when it comes to the motion tracking stuff. And so far in my life, the only thing I've gotten, and it is quite useful, is the tape measure app on the iPhone. Mm-hmm. And I know there's something there. I suspect that all of the AR is just on the other side of a display. You know, it's everything that I can think of that's going to be good about AR doesn't happen until there's a pair of decent looking glasses that fulfills that fake promise that Google Glass made all those years ago.
Oh, say that again.
I fear that everything I could think of that AR would be crazy useful for, and the ability to, you know,
only happen with glasses, right? Like they need the glasses,
right? It's on the.
Oh yeah.
I don't see any of it as long as we're.
No, I don't. Yeah, holding up your phone is dumb. It's they, you know, Apple is the ones when people ask like, why don't you do touchscreen iMacs? So they talked about Gorilla Arm and how holding your arm hand out like that. Apple's big on that. They're like, that was like, you know, that was like Steve Jobs. It's a dumb idea. Holding up your phone to do AR, yeah, it's dumb. And that's why I got big into developing some AR stuff. And I'm like, the hardware's not here yet. I mean, they can process it, but the hardware's not here yet. So, you know, what we need next is going to be the glass. And there's, you know, tons of, you know, there's patents and stuff on the glasses. And that's, you know, the, you know, rumors. I don't know what to believe, but I think that a very lightweight pair of glasses that you pop on, that you have, and you get that full anything in around you. If you get a chance, there's a Worldwide Developers Conference. If you look at like AR, their videos are, I think anybody can see the videos. They show, it's just a neat thing to see how the technology now is it can, the iPad, the Pro can map the environment in 3D. So if you have it in your living room, it will scan your living room in real time and create a map of your 3D map of your living room. Then that 3D objects can sit on. So we're looking at a bug that's just sitting on top of, you know, right now it's on a next to a tree by a tree trunk. The mapping, what they did there is we're watching the bug crawl behind the tree. And again, this is all real time. This is not,
you know what, you know what their play could be before we get to like a glasses AR thing. Maybe they come out with a competitor to the Oculus Quest type thing where it's just a full self-contained super, you know, very, very powerful VR headset that requires no lighthouses, that works anywhere. You may look silly out in public walking around with what looks like a mask over your eyes, but in a world where we're already wearing masks over, you know, our breathing parts, maybe it's straight up like, you walk around like, Kylo Ren. And meanwhile, you're experiencing a safe form of being out and about with a blended reality.
I would say that right now that would be very un-Apple.
I agree, you know? Because you would look dorky, right?
Well, and the idea that you're covering the face, it's like the behind the scenes story is that they've been trying to get things that are more glasses like whatever, because they like the Google Glass was a product Apple never really would have done because it was kind of socially inept, right?
Yeah.
In theory. And their goal would be something that's like, yeah, that not just looks cool, but the idea, let's not cover up your eyes. Let's still have human engagement, you know, not put you off in your own sort of bubble. Not to say that that would be a bad idea, you know, but for Apple, you know, there was one rumor that came up there, and I don't, you don't know how much to weigh on this, but it was like that they had two things. One of them would have been more like what you were saying, and it would have had to have like a remote processing unit that would be wirelessly connected. And the other one was a much less powerful, but just glasses sort of thing. And there was a company that I think that's getting bought by Google called North, which had kind of a better version of Google Glass, but it wasn't really it's not augmented reality really, where, as far as I understand, where it stays, floats around in your environment where it's supposed to be. But if you looked at North's VR stuff or AR stuff, much more stylish, you know, and I could see a lot easier to sort of look at a few example right there.
Let me throw something crazy out there. So as a society here in America, we're getting comfy with the idea of wearing masks. And we also have hot spots of political unrest where people are wearing masks for different reasons. What if you wore a mask that covered, your eyes like VR, but also your face with HEPA filters, whatever, for safety, but also masked your identity. And then, you could decide. And then if you see someone else with another unit on, it just projects whatever face they want to wear on there. If
Brian?
Yes.
I really want to read your cyberpunk novels.
Gotcha. All right.
Yeah.
I really want to read. That's what I want. I want the Schwitterverse. I really want to read these.
Something tells me I'm not going to get hired by Apple anytime soon. But
there might be another. But again, it's a bad idea. I mean, again, their way of doing a thing right now, but nobody knows. You know, Apple, like we said, like Apple spent billions trying to develop a self-driving car and gave up. They spent more money than Tesla did to develop their car, you know, initially. And you look at that and it shows you that, we were talking about Google in here, people are going, I love this, I love this. Like, yeah, those were all really cool software sort of stuff and software innovations and stuff. But on the hardware side, they haven't been pushing it because it's not presently in their DNA.
That,
you know,
might be the biggest difference between Apple and Google is both of them have the ability to give up on the sunk cost fallacy. Apple, of the two, is the only one that seems to have the ability to give up before they release it. Like Google, <Yeah. laughs> Google sinks the cost and then says, well, we might as well put it out, see if it's a hit, yeah. Google Plus. You know, like,
yeah. And let me put another point to Google's favor too. Like, they used to have really bad design. Really, they just felt like coders who said interface after the fact, and then they got dinged on it, and finally they sat down and they had a whole group come up with material design, which is, you know, what looks kind of the Google-ness stuff. They made that an open thing, and it's great. I use material design a lot. I think people can learn new stuff. I think they absolutely can learn new stuff. So I don't want to bag and say that, but yes, to your point, it's gonna be interesting. So I would say that, yeah, that's the problem with Google. My fear with any Google is like Google announces an initiative, they got so quick to cut public things. I think that was a problem with Stadia. It's like, hey, we've got this new thing called Stadia, and everybody's like, we're afraid to develop for you and get too involved because maybe you'll pull the plug. Oh no. And internally the group pushing it's like, oh no, we have full support. And then, you know, people have heard that before, and that might be the thing that may kill Stadia isn't so much after the technological kinks get kicked out. It may just be the fact that people are so afraid that Stadia will get canceled.
Which matters. It's one of those. It's huge. If we all believe it will work, then that's the only way it can work, because we all have to. Yeah. I mean, that's
especially with how they've set it up. Right. You have to buy your games. You're still paying $60 for games on Stadia. And if it goes away, it's not like you got a Steam key.
This is the console wars. I mean, this is every generation of growing up was like, well, you can only get a TurboGrafx or a Genesis, and you don't want to be caught with a TurboGrafx. It's fine. I love Bomb.
TurboGrafx, Brian.
Although I will say East Books 1 and 2 was awesome. Get out of here.
In Schwed Crash, the most important commodity is your TurboGrafx. God, what was the line from Hackers? The mainframe, forgot what they called it. You know what I'm talking about?
I remember the movie Hackers.
Yeah, that was a sort of like thing, because it is a wonderful movie, by the way.
The only bit, you know, I remember.
Oh, a Gibson. It was a after William Gibson. Oh, that's right. Is that the Gibson? No. We're like, oh, is that a Attorney of Brian the Schwitterverse? Oh, is that a TurboGrafx power of this? Oh,
there you go. And I remember Penn Jillette played a technician called Hal. And
Yeah. Fisher Stevens.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go back. It's an amazing film. More accurate now than we ever realized.
Either that or go visit the pool on the roof.
Yeah. 25th anniversary is coming up September 15th.
I'm old.
Just think about this. When Hackers came out, we're as far away from Hackers as Hackers was from 1970, a year after Woodstock.
Woodstock is that pivotal moment when I think about how far back. Like, I remember the 25th anniversary of Woodstock thinking, old people doing old things, remembering old things. And now anytime something's 25 years old, I'm just like...
And what's crazy too is that like I remember the 80s, you know, Woodstock was like, you know, like 14 years before, and it was an old thing, you know, it was an old, you know, kind of thing. And then, hey man, is that Freedom Rock? Turn it up.
That reference is longer than Woodstock ago.
I know, you'll know. But that's, yeah, so yeah, Hackers was our Woodstock apparently.
Hey man, you want to talk some picks?
Yep.
I've been playing The Last of Us Part Two with my daughter, and it's a mature title, and there's a lot of horrific, you know, killing and stuff, and it's a powerful story that is dark and gritty and has sad parts. So I spend a lot of time crying, and I'm so happy that a video game can cause me to do that, especially with my daughter. Like, there are sensitive and sweet moments, and, you know, she grabs the controller for those, and then she could tell, oh wait, scary parts are coming, and hands it back. Congratulations to everybody on that team. It's just a delight, and I'm not going to say anything more than that, because otherwise Justin's going to make a big deal about how I can't stop saying spoilers all the time.
Well, no, you'd have to do the Brian spoiler warning, which is, these are not spoilers. That's okay. How you know that Brian's about to spoil something is when he prefaces it with, this is not a spoiler. So is there any non-spoilers that you'd like to tell people about The Last of Us, so they know to mute this or go or skip forward?
Yes, this is not a spoiler, but things happen and characters become sad, and then characters remember earlier moments that are happy, and when they remember the earlier moments, they're happy. They're very poignant and sweet. That's not a spoiler.
I bet you Andrew could sketch out the entire plot. Andrew could right now, if he wanted to, just by guessing, like, he could just lay out character names too. Like, he would like get them right. Oh, like, descriptions of the clothing. Like,
okay. And that's it.
You got a pick, Andrew?
Oh my, okay, yeah, I do have a pick. This is a friend of the show, Ill Ink. She has been listening to us for a while, and I'm gonna talk about Elon Musk for a moment. Now comes the Elon Musk part of the show, which is fewer and fewer lately, but nonetheless, he is a very interesting figure. Fact, he is a person that is highly visible, says things that you realize, man, it takes a certain kind of personality to be an entrepreneur. And I think for many people, though, it's inspiring to see somebody who rewrote the laws of what's possible. And some people are like, him, whatever. If you don't care about him, whatever, just tune me out, whatever. But, you know, we have right now, we have astronauts on the International Space Station that got there on a spacecraft because an incredible team of people that he brought together, put this thing together and worked with NASA and made a lot. He's a guy that, you know, opened a door for a lot of people to say, yes, we want to be part of this and make this thing happen. And that to me is amazing. It is amazing because it's he frequently talks about my team. People just sort of think he only talks about himself, but that's a side point. But anyhow, he has been very inspiring to a lot of people, partially because he is a bit eccentric. And if you feel a little bit eccentric or a little bit out there, you kind of go, hey, there's another crazy person like me, and I respond to that. And that's what I like about him, because like I feel like the on the surface Elon Musk is a lot closer to sort of the maybe some of the erratic ways that I sometimes think. And other people have taken inspiration from him because of his big vision and also sort of his humanity, both, you know, maybe the unfiltered part too. And so Illink has created a coloring book, which is The Illuminated Tweets of Elon Musk. And basically what she's done is taken a number of his tweets and she's put them in the form of, you know, really, really beautifully done illustrations that you can then color. You know, she takes them, you know, takes the inspiration from the tweet and it does this. So if you check it out on Kickstarter, you can see her program. She was going for $10,000. She's now at $14,742 and, you know, 150 backers. There's still 15 days to go. And I think it's the illustrations are beautiful. And I think it's a really neat thing.
Somebody's going to go all out and put gold foil on it. And I mean, it's going to be like next level.
Yeah. So just give it a chance. Just take a look at it. Go to Kickstarter, look up Illuminated Tweets of Elon Musk or Elon Musk Coloring Book. And it's already been getting a lot of praise. So again, and I think that it's neat because I know a number of people have taken inspiration, particularly artists and some other minded people that know that, you know, my girlfriend is a huge fan. And, you know, she's not in the technical sort of fields, but, you know, watching somebody who's built amazing things and, you know, as an immigrant and having done that is, I think, inspiring to a number of people.
Cool.
So that's such a great concept. And yeah. I will definitely be backing this particular project. All right, I got a pick. I watched two shows over the weekend, and the first was Search Party. Search Party is a show that's on TBS, which apparently was some dumping ground for random nonsense and reruns of Home Improvement. But now that all of Warner Media has folded into HBO Max, it's a really cool HBO Max original. And it's really, really good. And there are elements for which I am delighted by. It is a very slicing in take on millennial culture in New York. It is one of those shows where you don't really know whether or not it hates its characters or it loves its characters. but it's all sitting on top of a very compelling and competent mystery. And so in its own ways, it reminds me of maybe, or certainly a more adult and a little bit more satirical version of Veronica Mars. Like Veronica Mars was a show where it wanted to put you in a place, but everybody was very much a human. In Search Party, they're a little cartoon character-y, but the mystery to it, you never lose the thread of wanting to find out what our protagonist Elias Shawcott is hunting down, and that's exceptional.
Is it anything like American Vandal? Where
it doesn't have the framing device of American Vandal.
Sure, yeah, but I guess
in that DNA, I would say that certainly if you liked American Vandal, there are notes here that you will like about Search Party. Although in its own ways, they are kind of they're kind of skewering some of the same elements of specifically murder porn or like murder stories and mysteries, like our new renaissance of that, but it's the real world version of it as opposed to fictional versions. But in that case, in American Vandal's case, they're skewering it from the perspective of the people that are doing it. In Search Party, if it is skewering anything, it's skewering the obsession of the fan.
Yeah, I guess with American Vandal, it took me three or four episodes to realize that I was unironically very invested in the mystery, because up until then I was just enjoying the parody. Does the mystery get you earlier in this one, or?
Oh no, it's the pilot will get you. Like, there is a very compelling, hook to it, and it's very deliberate in saying like there's. All the main stories are all about these like anywhere between vapid or young New Yorkers, and there's a lot of point and laugh to it, But it is very almost like mechanical on all of the main stories are about this mystery, and they give you, like a great mystery story should, just enough of that whoa, like at the right times to keep you going.
Mm-hmm. Also, Aaliyah Shawkat's character Dory is like really fascinating because it's not just that she makes bad choices. Like she consistently makes the wrong call. Sometimes, you know, maybe you wouldn't have known that was the wrong thing to do to like, no, you shouldn't. That's definitely the wrong thing to do in this situation. And because this the new one that's on HBO Max is season 3, so it unfolds further and further over the seasons, and you just see her in this new season just doing things wrong and and like, you know, her mental state is very weird. I don't think you would see someone who is in the positions that she's put in portrayed this way, right? It's not just David versus Goliath. It's also that David's walking the wrong direction and like looking at Goliath.
It is a lot of like that Reddit sleuthing, like when you smell, you know, where you believe things are going to end and you just can't stop pulling threads. And then you start, this is what's similar to American Vandal. You start pulling threads and you're like, oh God, like, what did I do that for? That's ridiculous.
Yeah. But yeah, Search Party is very good and it's very smart to put it on HBO Max. And now HBO Max has 3 seasons of a very good show.
As it turns out, a lot of great stuff is on TBS, but like, who would watch it? It's a station for basketball and Family Guy.
I have a super quick pick. This was I think I made this as a pick on Cord Killers last week, and I ended up binge watching it and finishing it, but it's the Netflix teen dramedy Never Have I Ever. It's more of a comedy than anything. It's very cool. It's about a teenage Indian girl who is, you know, living with her widowed mother and her cousin, and dealing with being a social outcast and coming of age. I think it's very well written. I think it's funny. I think the cast dynamic, because every high school teen show has to have a big ensemble cast now, is like really good and diverse and a lot of interesting storylines. And a lot of John McEnroe, who does a very good job of narrating the show. So,
like, I remember you said those words during Cord Killers, and I did the same Exorcist level head spin. Yeah. What?
He's great for it, and yeah, he intersects with the story in the end in a fun, cute way. It's also like it's so weird because it's like it's definitely John McEnroe saying like it's me, tennis pro John McEnroe.
Just but then, in case you're wondering, this is not an actor portraying me. It's me.
But how funny is that? That he is still so famous for getting mad playing tennis. Like that's what like and. I don't remember McEnroe playing. Like I'm in my late 30s and I don't think I ever watched him live in a non-charity situation. Like the oldest tennis players I remember are like Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras and stuff. But it's like, for whatever, boy, did that dude get mad. Everyone loved it so much and they've talked about it for 50 years.
So he's kind of a character in the universe, but then there's one episode that follows a different character, and instead of John McEnroe, they have Andy Samberg as himself narrating. It's me, Andy Samberg. This character has another character dynamic in the show.
By the way, none of this is
never
a spoiler.
It's no. Well, the Andy. Anyway, that's Never Have I Ever on Netflix. It's cute. It is very short, and I would love to see a season 2.
Cool.
Cool. That's our picks. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.